Seventh. The figure of Constantine the Great is at least as cardinal in history as that of Alexander the Great or Augustus Caesar. We know very little of his personality or of his private life. No Plutarch, no Suetonius has preserved any intimate and living details about him. Abuse we have of him from his enemies, and much obviously fulsome panegyric to set against it, but none of these writers give us a living character of him. He's a party symbol for them, a partisan flag. It's stated by the hostile Zosimus that, like Sargon I, he was of illegitimate birth. His father was a distinguished general, and his mother, Helena, an innkeeper's daughter of Nish in Serbia. Gibbon, however, is of opinion that there was a valid marriage. In any case, it was a lowly marriage, and the personal genius of Constantine prevailed against serious disadvantages. He was comparatively illiterate. He knew little or no Greek. It appears to be true that he banished his eldest son, Crispus, and caused him to be executed at the instigation of the young man's stepmother, Fausta. And it's also recorded that he was afterwards convinced of the innocence of Crispus and caused Fausta to be executed, according to one account, by being boiled to death in her bath, and according to another, by being exposed naked to wild beasts on a desolate mountain. While there's also very satisfactory documentary evidence that she survived him. If she was executed, the fact remains that her three sons, together with two nephews, became the appointed heirs of Constantine. Clearly there's nothing solid to be got from this libelous tangle, and such souffle as is possible with these scanty materials is to be found admirably done by Gibbon in chapter 18. Gibbon, because of his anti-Christian animus, is hostile to Constantine, but he admits that he was temperate and chaste. He accuses him of prodigality because of his great public buildings, and of being vain and dissolute because, in his old age, he wore a wig. Gibbon wore his own hair tied with a becoming black bow, and a diadem and magnificent robes. But all the later emperors after Diocletian wore diadems and magnificent robes. Yet if the personality of Constantine the Great remains phantom-like, if the particulars of his domestic life reveal nothing but a vague tragedy, we can still guess at much that was in his mind. It must, in the closing years of his life, have been a very lonely mind. He was more of an autocrat than any previous emperor had been, that's to say, he had less counsel and help. No class of public-spirited and trustworthy men remained. No senate nor council shared and developed his schemes. How much he apprehended the geographical weakness of the empire, how far he saw the complete disaster that was now so near, we can only guess. He made his real capital Nicomedia in Bithynia. Constantinople across the Bosphorus was still being built when he died. Like Diocletian, he seems to have realized the broken-backed outline of his dominions and to have concentrated his attention on foreign affairs, and more particularly on the affairs of Hungary, South Russia, and the Black Sea. He reorganized all the official machinery of the empire, he gave it a new constitution, and sought to establish a dynasty. He was a restless remaker of things. The social confusion he tried to fix by assisting in the development of a caste system. This was following up the work of his great predecessor, Diocletian. He tried to make a caste of the peasants and small cultivators, and to restrict them from moving from their holdings. In fact, he sought to make them serfs. The supply of slave labor had fallen off, because the empire was no longer an invading but an invaded power. He turned to serfdom as the remedy. His creative efforts necessitated unprecedentedly heavy taxation. All these things point to a lonely and forcible mind. It's in his manifest understanding of the need of some unifying moral force if the empire was to hold together that his claim to originality lies. It was only after he had turned to Christianity that he seems to have realized the fierce dissensions of the theologians. He made a great effort to reconcile these differences in order to have one uniform and harmonious teaching in the community, and at his initiative a general council of the church was held at Nicaea a town near Nicomedia and over against Constantinople, in 325. Eusebius gives a curious account of this strange gathering, over which the emperor, although he was not yet a baptized Christian, presided. It wasn't his first council of the church, for he had already in 313 presided over a council at Arles. He sat in the midst of the council of Nicaea upon a golden throne, and as he had little Greek, we must suppose he was reduced to watching the countenances and gestures of the debaters and listening to their intonations. The council was a stormy one. When old Arius rose to speak, one Nicholas of Myra struck him in the face, and afterwards many ran out, thrusting their fingers into their ears in affected horror at the old man's heresies. One's tempted to imagine the great emperor, deeply anxious for the soul of his empire, firmly resolved to end these divisions, bending towards his interpreters to ask them the meaning of the uproar. The views that prevailed at Nicaea are embodied in the Nicene Creed, a strictly Trinitarian statement, and the emperor sustained the Trinitarian position. But afterwards, when Athanasius bore too hardly upon the Arians, he had him banished from Alexandria, and when the church at Alexandria would have excommunicated Arius, he obliged it to readmit him to communion. 8. This date, 325 AD, is a very convenient date in our history. It's the date of the first complete general ecumenical council of the entire Christian world. That at Arles, we have mentioned, had been a gathering of only the western half. It marks the definite entry upon the stage of human affairs of the Christian Church and of Christianity as it's generally understood in the world today. It marks the exact definition of Christian teaching by the Nicene Creed. It's necessary that we should recall the reader's attention to the profound differences between this fully developed Christianity of Nicaea and the teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. All Christians hold that the latter is completely contained in the former, but that is a question outside our province. What's clearly apparent is that the teaching of Jesus of Nazareth was a prophetic teaching of the new type that began with the Hebrew prophets. It wasn't priestly, it had no consecrated temple and no altar, it had no rites and ceremonies. Its sacrifice was a broken and a contrite heart. Its only organization was an organization of preachers, and its chief function was the sermon. But the fully fledged Christianity of the 4th century, though it preserved in its nucleus the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, was mainly a priestly religion of a type already familiar to the world for thousands of years. The center of its elaborate ritual was an altar, the essential act of worship, the sacrifice, by a consecrated priest, of the Mass. And it had a rapidly developing organization of deacons, priests, and bishops. But if Christianity had taken on an extraordinary outward resemblance to the cults of Serapis, Ammon, or Bel-Marduk, we must remember that even its priestcraft had certain novel features. Nowhere did it possess any quasi-divine image of God. There was no head temple containing the God, because God was everywhere. There was no Holy of Holies. Its widespread altars were all addressed to the unseen universal Trinity. Even in its most archaic aspects, there was in Christianity something new. A very important thing for us to note is the role played by the emperor in the fixation of Christianity. Not only was the Council of Nicaea assembled by Constantine the Great, but all the great councils, the two at Constantinople, in 381 and 553, Ephesus in 431, and Chalcedon in 451, were called together by the imperial power. And it's very manifest that in much of the history of Christianity at this time, the spirit of Constantine the Great is as evident as, or more evident, than the spirit of Jesus. He was, we've said, a pure autocrat. The last vestiges of Roman republicanism had vanished in the days of Aurelian and Diocletian.